Right. Good morning, everyone. My name is Christopher Shepherd. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Arizona in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science, and I'm going to be presenting a little bit of my dissertation work that I'm doing with Craig Rasmussen and Marcel Schopp. It's going to be talking about how we can use probability distributions to understand soil development or evolution and quantifying that with time, or quantifying that across time. So the theoretical approach that we're taking to understand the soil evolution variability is to really understand how soils are changing through time. So one way that we can think of it is with this evolutionary pathway sort of framework. So on the x-axis we have time, and then the y-axis we have soil property S. And so there are a number of different pathways that we may see on a landscape, and that we could observe any of these different pathways at any different time or any different locations. They're all equally probable or likely. And so with that in mind, if we go to a landscape, we could observe potentially soils that represent each of these different time zones. So hypothetically, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 4, or 10 to the 6 years. And so I've represented those with different colored bars. And as you can see, with time, perhaps the range of distributions in soil properties or soil states that we observe may change. And instead of perhaps representing this with a mean or a median, I think that we should be representing this distributionally with probability. To say that as time progresses forward, we have these differing distributions that we may observe on the landscape. So there's a different, the range of soil properties that we may observe changes with time. And that this is likely the most appropriate way in which to represent how a soil landscape may evolve over time, but operationally, it may be quite difficult. But in order to test whether or not we actually do observe this process or this kind of distributional type change in soil properties, we have done a global literature review of about 45 different Carnot sequence studies, and that represented or resulted in about 400 different profiles. So it's about 416 different profiles. And we looked at sand, silt, and clay content changes with time, but we also looked at solum. And we focused on the maximum measured texture content within the soil profile, but we also looked at depth weighted. But for today's talk, due to time constraints, I'm going to be focusing primarily on maximum clay content and how that changes with time. So this is just a map just showing where all the different sequences are. I guess it was global. We have sequences represented in almost every single continent. But not surprisingly, the vast majority of sequences were located in North America and Europe. But we also have lots of sequences in like Taiwan and stuff, but those are weird soils. All right, so on to some of the results. So this is a square root transform, so just keep that in mind when I show you any numbers. It's going to be a little wonky. But these are the differing probability distributions, and we've binned them by age category. So it goes from 10 to the 2 on the left over to 10 to the 6 on the far right, and they're changing with color as well. And so as you can see, when we do bend them like this, we do see this really interesting and very discrete distributions between the different age categories or age bins. And we see this playing out really, really well when we look at the standard deviations. So again, you know, square root transform, that's why the numbers are so low. It's not like amazing or anything. But we see 1.24 at the youngest soils, 10 to the 2. So there's relative similarity where they all start or where soil formation initially begins. And then as you go from 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, and 10 to the 5 years, so we see this broadening of the distributions. We see a really large increase in the standard deviation. So within this time zone, 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 5, we see all of this variability in the possible soil states that we could observe on the landscape. And then finally, at 10 to the 6 years, we see, again, convergence in soil properties. So it's saying that the oldest soils are all really similar, at least when we're looking at them in this kind of abstract way or broad brush. So this is kind of showing that the theoretical approach that we have decided to take is it really does play out within the data that we see within the literature. So what is controlling these distributions or the shape of these distributions? So I have just a simple table here. Age category, again, is exactly the same as what we were just looking at. And I've used EEMT, or effective energy and mass transfer. It is a representation of climate. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about that in the next slide. But if you're not familiar with it, it's really just it quantifies the amount of flux from climate, so precipitation primarily, and net primary productivity into the soil system. And then there's also the geomorphic landform and then parent material. And so initially, what is controlling the shape of the distributions seems to be geomorphic surface, or what surface they initially begin to form on. And so it, you know, that was the strongest predictor at 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, and 10 to the 4 years, or in those categories. At 10 to the 5 years, we finally begin to see a strong climactic signature. So that would really seem to indicate, at least, that it requires at least 100,000 years for a climactic signature to be imprinted upon the soil properties. So at 10 to the 5 years, it would seem that that distribution is being controlled by a combination of climate and a combination of geomorphic surface. And finally, when you get to 10 to the 6 years, the only thing that really is beginning to control soil properties is parent material. So it kind of seems to say that where you end up what you ended up as has an influence of where you started. So it's kind of this really holistic system that you have to like take everything into account. We can't separate it all. So just to reiterate the main points from this table, geomorphic surface initially controls variation, and that a strong climactic signature requires about 10 to the 5 years to be imprinted upon the soil. Well, clay, because that's what we're talking about. So the next thing that we've done is we've kind of said, how do we begin to represent the system? Or is there a way that we could model this process that we have seen play out in the Carnot sequence of data? And one of the ways that we've done that is we've taken this original state vector model that we're all familiar with, and we've kind of simplified it or really boiled it down to the most simplest basic terms possible. So let me just say this now. I'm not solving it or doing anything special. It's just we're simplifying it in a really abstract ways. So as I was talking earlier, EEMT, or effective energy and mass transfer, it's a quantification of the flux terms within the state vector model, so climate and organics. And what EEMT quantifies is the effective energy from effective precipitation, so precipitation minus potential evapotranspiration, and then the chemical energy that's added to the soil through organic matter through net primary productivity. And because EEMT is a flux term over 1 year, what we've done next is we've multiplied that by the age of the soil system, or time. So now we're bringing in time into this equation. And so we've kind of termed this new term called total pedogenic energy, which obviously this isn't all the energy that has fluxed through the soil system. It's a potential that could be observed based on modern climate. So this new TPE term, we can take that and we can add that back into the original state factor equation. So now we've taken it from a five-factor equation down to a three-factor equation. And sticking with the theme of probability that we've been using for the first part of the talk, we've elected to represent the state factor equation from a probabilistic sense, saying that the probability that a soil, down here, the probability that a soil will be between a lower probable limit, S sub 1, and an upper probable limit, S sub 2, is primarily a function of its total pedogenic energy, or the amount of energy that it has received over its lifetime. And that by taking this distributional type approach, we're implicitly capturing relief in parent material, or those influences upon the soil system. We're not limiting ourselves in any way to what surfaces we're looking at, or to what parent materials we're looking at as well. So a little bit of the model background. I've kind of already gone into the total pedogenic energy term in detail, but it's just that we really just need to take into account all the energy that's flowing through the soil system over the lifetime of that soil system. And then that's just, you know, how it's very simple calculation. It's just the annual EEMT value multiplied by the age of the soil system. And the probability structure that we've chosen to use is that we've parameterized these joint probability distributions between the selected soil properties that we're talking about, so in this case, maximum clay content, and then total pedogenic energy. And from that joint probability distribution, we can then calculate conditional distributions. And then those conditional distributions can be used to predict or constrain the probable soil properties that we may see at a given location based off of a given total pedogenic energy value. So this is what this probability surface actually looks like. So the equation is down there is at the bottom if you're interested in it. It's a little complicated in math, like bleh. But you can see the probability surface between total pedogenic energy on the x and then the square root of maximum clay content on the y, and we see there's a peak probability at, you know, between the two means of those two values, but it's probably easier to look at it on the right when you see the concentric circles. This concentric red ellipses, I guess, would represent lines of equal probability between a correlation of total pedogenic energy, which is on the x again, and maximum clay content, which is on the y. So using this now bivariate distribution, we can calculate univariate distributions. And from that univariate distribution, we can constrain the soil properties that we might see. And that is, this is what this would look like. It doesn't show up quite well on this projector. Sorry about that. But we've predicted the measured maximum clay content and the predicted maximum clay content. And we've these represent the conditional univariate means that you would use to, say, parameterize a normal probability distribution. And how we've done this, in order to predict values and not have any influence of what we actually predicted, we've used LEAD-1 out cross-validation. So we have 45 different chronosequence studies. We take out one study from that base, and we use the 45 remaining studies to calculate all the parameters for the model, and then we calculate the left-out study to calculate the conditional univariate means from that study's given total petagenic energy values. And this is what this figure represents. So we've binned this out again as igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary, so those are just its broad paramaterial types. The one on the far right represents a correlation between the measured maximum clay content and the predicted maximum clay content on the Y for all of the values, or for all of the different paramaterials. And we've also taken the geomorphic surface for each of these sequences, and that's what all the different shapes represent, just to make sure that there's nothing is weird, like maybe one type is like different than another type or something, you never know. And so what we see is that for each of the different paramaterials, we're doing a relatively good job. The model gets about over an R squared of 0.5 between the measured and the predicted. And when we're looking at all of them and one correlation together, the R squared was 0.54. So it's saying that, you know, the model actually does a pretty good job without really knowing anything about the soil system. We don't need to know that much about what's actually happening in the soil in order to predict what may probabilistically be there. Not what is there, but what the constraint that we might see. And so, again, down below, that's the equation that you would use to calculate this univariate mean. So finally, some concluding thoughts about what I've discussed today. I've presented a new framework for how we could possibly describe soil evolution variability in the systems that we're observing now. And then, really one of the main conclusions is that geomorphic surface initially controls soil variation, but that a really strong climactic signature appears to require 10 to the 5 years in order to be imprinted upon the soil. And that finally, this is a really simplistic and probabilistic, but it's a data-driven way of representing the state factor equation that we're all really used to using, and it's widely applicable. There's no reason why this couldn't be applied anywhere upon the Earth's surface. So with that, I just need to acknowledge my funding sources, the National Science Foundation for its support of the Catalina Jimenez Critical Zone Observatory, as well as the University Fellows Program through the Graduate Center at the University of Arizona, and then several people who have also helped me collect chronosequence data from the literature, because reading a bunch of studies over and over again is bad. So anyway, thank you, and that's all my contact information if you have any other questions that you want to say out loud right now.
Okay. We've got time for a question or two. Yes.
Yeah, so that's actually a really difficult thing to do. There's lots of different methods that you can use for dating soils. I know Kyung-Soo Yu, the guy in Minnesota, he actually did a study that aged the flux of the soil particles down the hill slope and was like, you need to take this into account. And unfortunately, when you're using studies that haven't really... studies from like the 70s or 60s, where we didn't have these methods available that we have today now, taking something that into account is very difficult. So there are really broad error bars on all of the ages within all of these chronosequence studies. So that's obviously a source of uncertainty within any of these models. But that by taking this probabilistic distribution or this probabilistic sense, we're kind of saying, yeah, this is, you know, the problem. We know we have all this error and this uncertainty, but this is maybe one way that we could use that uncertainty or variability by taking this really broad brush approach and quantifying that all together. I'm not sure I answered your question the way you wanted.
No,
How do I? So this is the age of the soil that the publishers, the authors who publish the study, this is how old this is what it's going to be. So it kind of is really up to them how they define the age. We didn't restrict ourselves in any way. So it could have been since Asia's last glaciation. We did not use any buried soils or buried horizons. It had to be at the surface because that obviously constrains things. Like if you're, 20 feet down or something, what's going to happen to you? Not much. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Move along.